If you are present, please log in on the computer. 21 board members present, 9 excused, and 5 absent, some of which I think are still showing up. Let's continue, though, with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, what we need to start out with is swearing in of Karen Johnson by Judge Horn.
All right, well, it's good to be back. With respect to our car, and I guess you all made her sit over in the bleachers, but I promised her there'd be a seat for her to remain there and afterwards. So, Karen, if you would raise your right hand, repeat after me. I, Karen L. Johnson.
I, Karen L. Johnson.
Oh, wait a second. I'm going to take pictures here.
Judges are used to being the center of attention, so I know this is going to be tough for you.
All right, we'll try again. I, Karen L. Johnson.
I, Karen L. Johnson.
Having been appointed to the office of County Board Supervisor, District 5.
Having been appointed to the office of County Board Supervisor, District 5.
Swear or affirm that I will support the Constitution of the United States.
Swear or affirm that I will support the Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of Wisconsin. Faithfully and impartially discharge the duties of this office to the best of my ability.
And will faithfully and
impartially
execute discharge the duties of this office to the best of my ability.
So help me God.
So help me God.
You see, usually I go in really small pieces, but.
That's okay, Karen. We all get hung up on that impartial part. We don't understand that concept. Thank you, Judge. Next up, we have Jason Witt. I think you need to turn that on.
Okay, how's that? Okay. Wanted to come here today and make the county board aware that the Human Services Department's very own Jane Clay Kemp recently received a very prestigious award on April 27th in Wisconsin Rapids. She won the ALLIC Award, which is an award given annually by the Wisconsin Association of Treatment Court Professionals. It's named after Jack Ollick, who's a Wisconsin judge who was really considered to be a pioneer of drug courts in the state of Wisconsin. Jane was recognized in part for her tremendous contribution to the development of the drug court and related programming here in La Crosse County, but really largely for her work in being a good partner in spreading the word and providing technical assistance to other jurisdictions in the state and throughout the country who are implementing also drug treatment courts. And she's really seen as a national leader in this area. It's really due to Jane's work and passionate professionals like her that more and more jurisdictions are adopting the drug treatment court model. And La Crosse was really out in the forefront in being one of the pioneers of drug treatment courts. And things have come a long way since then nationally. And it's a model that's gained widespread recognition. It's commonly accepted today as a more effective way to address crime. So we are very proud of Jane and happy to have her as part of the Human Services team and in the county team, and have the award here, which looks very nice, and would like Jane to come up and say a couple of words about the award.
So I just, first, all of you, some of you may remember this, not all of you would remember this, when we started the drug treatment court about 10 years ago. And I remember Judge Perlich being very stern with all of you who were here at that time and forcing you to promise that you would support the drug treatment court. And I just want to say that it has been, you know, in place now for a little over 10 years and is going strong. And I think it was really the springboards for a lot of the evidence-based practice in the OWI treatment court and the women's community-based program, and has all of those things we continue to review and look at, and it shows good results every time we review them. So I just want to thank all of you, because without the county board, we wouldn't have a drug treatment court or an OWI treatment court or any of the programs. So thanks for all your support. I really appreciate it.
Congratulations, Jane. All right, that gets us to, yes, John Menninger.
I also wanted just to echo the praise for Jane Claycamp and my old high school classmate, John Perlich, who I think was a very stern judge but grew to be a very compassionate human being in drug court. My son is a graduate of that court, and Jane and I have had lots of discussions. She's just a great person.
Vicki Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a few weeks ago, Jane had the opportunity to present at a national conference related to the transitioning from jail to community that we've been doing, the initiative with the Urban Institute and the National Institute of Corrections. And she had high praise there for her presentation. And so it's just another way in which she has national recognition for the work that she's been doing.
All right. Again, congratulations, Jane, and thank you for all that you do. That gets us to the next item, which is the County Board picnic date and time. We have a couple options, the main two being July and August. If I'm correct, Mr. O'Malley would not be here if it's in July. Is that right?
Not if it's during that committee.
Oh, or County Board Week?
County Board Week, I'm here for.
County Board Week, you're here. I'm actually not here that day. If you want to have it without me, that's fine. Otherwise, we're looking at August 18th. The tradition is that the county board chair does that, and as of either of those dates, I will not be the county board chair, so it's going to be somebody else's responsibility. Just so we don't do it in June, that's the only thing I'm concerned about. So, does anybody have a preference between July and August? Ain't going to happen, Ray. Actually, we have a... It's anybody from the town of Hamilton, if we have it in early summer, I think is the history that we've had here. Anybody have a preference, June versus or July versus August? Is August okay? I see no problems there. All right, that sounds good. Question then, the last few years we have done a morning. We have a morning meeting, start at 9 o'clock, finish off by late morning, and do the picnic over the noon hour. Before we make any decisions in that respect, I'm going to ask Jerry to tell us, he'll be like the Vanna White, describing all of the wonderful things that await us if we win.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd rather wait for my co-chair, Arlene Benrud, who is gone. She'll be hosting, chairing the Wisconsin Highways all week. And the menu is pretty well set. The main ingredient would be stuffed pork loins, stuffed with mushrooms and Italian sausage sauce, one of the main items. And have the rest of it would be pretty much traditional, chair, the potato salad, the beans, and things like that. And I will distribute everybody a complete menu at our next month's meeting.
Sounds great.
And we held the price again for the third year, and it'll also be hosted by the Varsity Club again this year at Ball's Catering.
Sounds good. Tara Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the request of the Sunshine Committee, as I'm affectionately referring to Jerry and Arlene, I would move that the county board hold its August meeting beginning at 9 a.m. to accommodate the picnic schedule.
Is there a second? Seconded by Vicki Burke. Discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously, so we will meet 9 a.m. Thursday, August 18th. And next Thursday at our regular county board meeting, we'll have any further update from Jerry and Arlene. Okay, then we now have Grace Jones, who's going to give the annual Cooley Cat presentation. Grace, if you can come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and congratulations on your recent election.
Thank you.
Thank you for a few minutes on your agenda this evening. For the newer board members, Cooley Cap is a private nonprofit corporation. We serve four counties, La Crosse, Monroe, Vernon, and Crawford, and have a 24-member board, about 70 staff, and our mission is to help families and communities achieve economic self-sufficiency. Somewhere in front of you, you have an annual report that has, as my assistant said, green that pops. So it looks like this. And I think it's a wonderful report. You might want to take a look at it sometime. This talks about the agency as a whole, But then there is a one-page report just on La Crosse County that has pictures, and on the front features our Rockland project, and I'm actually going to focus on that first. You may be aware that there was a property over in Rockland that was having some pretty substantial problems, and as a result of our work with your planning department, Steve O'Malley, Charlie Handy, Cooley Cap became involved over in Rockland, and I'm really happy to say that we have constructed 4 new homes over in Rockland on that problematic property. We're doing another 4. There's a great demand for this housing. We've had no problem selling the properties. So eventually, Cooley Cap will be building 16 properties there, and also 3 duplexes that will be rental units, a total of 6 rental units. So on there, you can see some of the pictures of the homes that we've been putting up. They're really quite nice. And I would be glad to give you further information on that, how the deal works, if you're interested. Then on the back of that page, some highlights from La Crosse County. This is less information that you used to get than you used to get. It's a little more targeted to major things that we're doing in the county. First, the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, which was new funding as part of the kind of housing recovery of the country. We were awarded $1.6 million in federal NSP funds. This allowed us to purchase foreclosed properties, rehabilitate them, and sell them. And in 2010, we worked with 10 homes. Also in our housing development area, we've been, last couple of years, you've heard me talk about the Cooley Community Land Trust. And I'm happy to say that we currently have 7 homes in the land trust, even though it's just a couple of years old. One of those homes is in Rockland. And within the next 18 months or so, we'll have a total of 17 homes in the land trust. So when you look at land trusts nationally, this is a pretty rapid growth rate, and we're happy about that. We have a pretty strong homeless program division at Cooley Cap, and we were able to help 94 families. And we were also able to subcontract to the YWCA, the Salvation Army, the Options Clinic, and Legal Action to help with these homeless families in our community. In home rehab, we were able to work on 8 homes. In home weatherization, 349 were weatherized, which has a really substantial impact on the energy costs for those low-income families. And then in our People Helping People Fund, which is where we take receive private donations and then help families with their immediate needs, we were able to serve 50 different families. All in all, we employ 19 residents of La Crosse County, programming totaling 3.4 plus million. Very grateful for the support of the county board, especially in those housing development initiatives. Our 2 board members appointed by the county board chair are Maureen Friedland and Monica Cruz, and they just do an excellent job on the CAP board. I want to thank you for all of your support. Currently, I'm chair of the Family Policy Board, so I'm getting to work a lot with Jason Witt, the new Human Services Director, who he's still here, but I'll be nice anyway. It's a real pleasure to work with, and a wonderful new leader that you've hired in the county. And then Jill Billings, too, works with me on the Family Policy Board, and that's just been a pleasure to spend time with Jill. So we just had a really busy year in 2008. We served 38,000 people. When you add up all the various programs that Cooley Cap has throughout the 4 counties, and another 17,000 were served through the Recovery Act funding or the stimulus funding. We were able to hire about 20 people to help us handle that additional Recovery Act funding and to serve those 17,000 people. So we're worried about the economy, how well it's doing, whether it's really improving. All of those Recovery Act dollars are spent, basically spent at this point. So we hope for a good economic recovery so that we don't have so many folks coming to our door in need. I'd be glad to try and answer any questions. Otherwise, that concludes my report.
Any questions? Ralph Geary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see it says income-eligible buyers. What is that? I mean, what is the eligibility or whatever the criteria is?
Can you get me to what program you're talking about? In Rockland?
Yes, in Rockland.
I believe Rockland is 80% of county medium income is the income eligibility. Although we did have one house that we were able to put up and have, I think, at 50% county median income.
Because we don't have mass transit there, as John will bring up shortly, but you'd have to be able to provide your own transportation. You'd have to have a vehicle,
right,
insurance and all that other stuff, and you can
exactly this
make that payment with 80% of the county. Well, I don't know what 80% of the county median is. Is it?
It's roughly like for a family of four, around $45,000, I think.
Is that what it is?
Although anybody can correct me if they know.
Are any of these
the
things
number?
Being built in the city of La Crosse?
Sorry?
Are any of these housing projects like this being built in La Crosse, the city of La Crosse?
In terms of brand new housing, the focus we've had is on that neighborhood stabilization program where we were buying up foreclosed properties, rehabbing them, and then selling them. And years ago we built some new housing in the city of La Crosse, but we haven't. I think Habitat and the city's housing replacement program has done most of that.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? All right. Grace, thank you. Steve.
I just wanted to take a moment to really recognize and thank Cooley Cap and in particular Todd Mandel and Charlie Handy, who have done the lion's share of work on this. I think it's just an amazing turnaround that to be in a position where we received 55 tax forfeited lots because of some poor decisions financially on putting in infrastructure before there was a market demand, and with a matter of a couple of years to be able to see, did I get this right, 16 homes plus three duplexes?
Right now we've built four.
You built four.
We're in the process of building another four. And then our total goal is to build 16 plus three duplexes.
I just wanted to hear this over again because this is one-third of all those lots due to the work of our staff and Todd Mandel and Cooley Cap. This is just an amazing turnaround for a small community that really was between a rock and a hard place, and it helps us get the money back from the special assessments. But more importantly, it's a need that's being filled. People are driving from there, either working in that community or West Salem or Sparta or nearby, and it's not where we might have planned to do a development, but obviously, given the situation, this is really turning a bad situation around, and just really want to appreciate Cooley Cap, in particular Todd, who's right. done the lion's share of this, as I understand it, and Charlie on our staff.
We couldn't have done it without Charlie, definitely. And then Todd Mandel, I think some of you have seen him in committee meetings, and he is our housing development, now community development person, who is really making this happen. So, yes, thank you, Steve.
Anybody else? Okay. Again, Grace, thank you very much. All right, that gets us to Supervisor Conference Reports. Tara Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to just take a moment and do the Western Wisconsin CARES report since I've been negligent for a few months now. You should have on your desks two pieces of paper, one that says Western Wisconsin CARES 2010 Annual Review of Key Matrix. That's actually printed two sides, and then a second sheet that compares the county waiver system to family care. Just briefly, the first sheet, that annual review of key matrix, are some indicators of the 2010 calendar year, which is our program year at Western Wisconsin CARES. Eight counties, just buzzing through these points, these are reminders to you. The population we serve are frail, elderly, adults with developmental and or physical disabilities. At the end of 2010, there were 3,312 members, which I'm guessing might come as a surprise to folks who might remember the numbers when La Crosse County operated the care management organization. And I think before it left La Crosse County, it was just shy or just over 2,000 members. So as we've added in those other counties and in La Crosse County, the program has grown. Our numbers have evolved. I would also, that's as of December 31st, just as a note, as of May 31st of this year, you might want to write this in, that the membership had grown to 3,527. So family care continues to grow in Western Wisconsin. The employment numbers are there. The offices are in Alma and Toma and Neillsville and La Crosse and one other place that I can't remember. but hopefully it will come to me. The provider network managing 900 contracts, that's just an indicator of the number of providers. Some of them are individuals who provide in-home supports or any number of services to the members, but it could also represent a large provider like Gunderson Lutheran or SaluCare, or so that 900 contracts represent really a broad spectrum of providers. But it's a huge network to be able to provide services in an 8-county area. The annual quality review is performed for each of the managed care organizations, and Western Wisconsin Cares, again, had a very positive annual quality review. I think the financial performance also is important for us to pay attention to, that we went into 2009 with a loss and came out of 2010 to the good. So that turnaround has been particularly important as we head into a pretty uncertain financial time as the next biennial budget looms. And if that leads me to the back side of that sheet of paper, hopefully what you have on the back is the proposed cap on family care and the concerns that have been raised as a result of that. If you think of Western Wisconsin Cares and the other managed care organizations in the state, they really are insurance providers of services, non-medical, non-acute services. And the whole notion of insurance is that as you grow your insured, you spread the risk over a larger pool of folks, and that helps keep the costs down for everyone. That's kind of a basic tenet of insurance. What's being proposed in the biennial budget is to cap enrollment for family care. And that will mean that we cannot continue to grow. And as you've seen from the numbers on the flip side, we have been doing that significantly each of the last several years. So this notion of a cap really places a burden on the managed care organizations. And you can see there a number of reasons why that causes concern for us. I think Jason agreed to stick around for a minute in case there are any questions about the impact that this will have on the county, but it might be a topic for another planning meeting or another report as well. But I wanted to make sure that you understood the connection between what's being proposed in the biennial budget and potential impact on La Crosse County. I will just ask you, when you have time, to take a look at that second sheet of paper that compares the waiver system to family care. It really is just some more background information and will help you, I think, understand this potential risk for not only the managed care organizations, but also for counties. It's pretty significant. So unless anybody has any questions, that's kind of an overview of Western Wisconsin Cares, and I would be happy to try and answer any questions if anybody has them.
Anybody have any questions?
Thank you.
I guess not. Thank you, Tara Johnson. Any other supervisor conference reports? Monica Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I recently attended the Western Region WALDAB Board of Health educational event, along with several other supervisors. I'd like to focus on the aspect of public health. Others might want to address some other aspects of that conference. And public health is concerned with the health of the community as a whole. It's a cost-effective program. For every dollar spent on prenatal WIC, we save $3. Every dollar spent on home visiting for pregnant women and new mothers saves us $5. We save $5 for worksite wellness for every dollar spent, $27 for childhood immunization, $3.40 for heart disease prevention, and for every dollar spent on water fluoridation, we save $38. We got some pretty sobering information regarding the funding. Public health is predominantly funded through federal block grants. 73% comes from that. 15% from the general program revenue and 12% from regular program revenue. At the federal level, the 2011 budget will decrease monies by between 10 and 20% of many of the block grant funds. And the 2012 budget Decreases in most of the block grants starting in October 2011, including complete elimination of the prevention block grant. And the only increase we will see is in monies from the Affordable Care Act. At the state level, Joint Finance is currently in the process of reviewing those budgetary proposals, and it looks like there will be a 10% across the board cut and decreases in complete elimination of family planning funds for men, tobacco funding I think has been restored at this point, and other cuts. So I think we need to do what we can to lobby to keep those monies in the budget. And that's my part of the report.
Thank you, Monica. Don Bina, did I see your hand up?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a number of issues that we went to a meeting on Friday for the RC&D, and we are coordinating the RC&D so we stay in existence. Even though we're balancing the budget federally and 375 coordinators are released as of last month, it's interesting to know. I called John Menninger, and I found out also that on the federal level, the earmark that Senator Cole had in his request over the last any number of years for grazing in the state of Wisconsin totally got thrown out of his reach within the last couple of weeks. We were forced, well, there are seven RC&Ds in the state, and each one has a grazing coordinator. That grazing coordinator was given termination notice as of June 30th, so the program is going to be gone. We have two office managers coordinating activities in the state. They're going to be gone. It allowed fencing, watering system for young and middle-aged farmers on the farm. So they're cutting pretty soundly into the farm programs. Last week on Wednesday or Thursday, the state Finance Committee, knowing or unknowingly, threw out the total NR 151 budget. They were going to be talking about the stormwater issues, and had a lot of concerns about that, but their vote threw all of our conservation compliance rules right out the window, and unless they're reinstated, we're going to be going with the federal rules, which are pretty minimal in nature. So there are a lot of things happening. They're taking a lot of money away from the farming and the farming sector, both on the state and on the federal level, and I don't like to see that. So I will be calling Senator Cole's office in the morning.
Thank you, Don. Sharon Hampson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I went to the WALDAB State Conference in Appleton, and Margaret Wood was sworn in as the new co-president of the state organization, and I presented a really stunning thing on the role of the Board of Health in public health accreditation. It was amazing. I stayed awake, let alone the audience. But most of public health is more interesting, and I went to a really cool session on bed bugs and how they're spreading and what public health departments need to be ready to do. And the most interesting thing that I heard was that when you go into a hotel room, they recommend that you tear the headboard off the wall and examine behind it and the wood that's holding it to the wall and see if you can find any bed bugs there. Then,
is that why you called me for bail this weekend?
Then you strip off every layer of bedding, including removing the mattress and the box springs, and examining each and every. And then I guess you sleep on the floor or in the bathtub or something. It's just bizarre. I mean, like, they're saying this like it's a real solution. I'm like, you must be crazy. But anyway, I also found out a new word, hydrofracturing, which is shooting water and chemicals into the ground to release natural gas. So that's another concern that's coming up. So that's it. Any questions about bed bugs? I got it all here.
Mr. Ebert, do you have a question about bed bugs?
No, not about that. I just would ask the our supervisor, when they're giving reports, to the initials, to at least give us the real name the first time. And I don't have
what's WALDAB, in other words?
Well, I was thinking of
it's Wisconsin Association of Local Health Departments.
Yeah, that, I mean, at least the first time, I think it's a courtesy to those of us who are not in the know.
And RC&D is?
Resource Conservation and Development.
Okay, good
thank
point.
Thank you very much.
Good point, Ray. Thanks. Margaret Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is part three of the Wisconsin Association of Local Health Departments and Boards. I, too, was at both of those meetings with Sharon and Monica. And the wonderful thing is that the message was very fluid between the two meetings. The future of public health is in the ability of our public health professionals to partner with others in the community. And, of course, not surprising to us, La Crosse County is already doing that. We're already engaged in the future by adopting the Complete Streets program. We have had efforts at fluoridation throughout the county. We're doing the footsteps to health and the chefs in schools. And public health, we were encouraged to be present as we plan for all aspects of our community, because really public health is everywhere. In one of my welcoming, I said public health was like Chicken Man, for those of you that remembered that radio show of the 70s. Chicken Man, he's everywhere. Well, that's what public health is. So as we talk about transportation, the environment, economic development, et cetera, I was at one more thing, though, that Monica and Sharon were not at, and that was the first meeting of the Strong Seniors Program, which also is part of the grant to our health department. It was at the Echo Park, and over 110 seniors came to exercise to increase our bone density and to rid ourselves of arthritic pain. So before the program even started, it's a winner. So thank you, Public Health Department of La Crosse County.
Thank you, Margaret. That program, Footsteps to Where?
Footsteps to health. It's when
that wasn't what I thought you said.
Oh, was it footsteps to wealth?
Oh, yeah. There you go. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Okay.
Health.
Health. Okay. I have to enunciate. All right. Anybody else have any reports? Is there any objection to us going out of order and doing appointments right now? Tara Johnson needs to leave at 7, and I'm going to need her to take over for just a second to do the appointments. Any objection to that? Seeing none, we'll do that.
Chairman Doyle.
Thank you. I have three appointments, and they are to the City County Housing Task Force. And in fact, these are the three people who volunteered. So I'm happy to appoint each of them, Tara Johnson, Tina Weirs, and Jill Billings.
Is there a second? Seconded by Audrey Cotter. Discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Those appointments are made unanimously.
Thank you. That gets us to the administrator's report. Mr. O'Malley.
Yes, I have a proclamation, but I wanted to just take 2 seconds or a couple minutes to recognize. I don't know how many of you noticed over the last 2 weeks there were little signs on a number of our doors around announcing Jeans Week for the tornado victims, and that was the brainchild of our county clerk, Ginny Dankmeyer, who suggested that we do this countywide. And I'm pleased to announce that as of today, county employees have donated over $4,048 to the work of American Red Cross.
Wow.
So I just think it's amazing and an indication of the kind of dedication that we have, Ginny, to have a wonderful idea, to promote it, to coordinate it, and also employees to step up and try to help. Many of our own, there are 7 or 8 individual employees that had major damage to their homes. You may have heard of some of them, but I didn't want it to go on too much longer without mentioning that. Ginny, what a great, inspiring job to do. I appreciate it, and I know we're proud of you. The proclamation I have is on Parks and Natural Resources Month. June 2011, whereas the county park system and our natural resources are an integral part of the La Crosse County community, and whereas the quality of our parks and natural resources provide safe and healthy places for residents and visitors to recreate and enjoy, whereas residents and visitors are encouraged to educate themselves and adopt responsible lifestyles that preserve the beauty and value of our parks and natural resources, whereas La Crosse County employees from the Facilities Department and the Department of Land Conservation serve to educate, protect, maintain, and enhance the quality of our parks and natural resources, now therefore be it resolved, La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the month of June 2011 is La Crosse County Parks and Natural Resources Month and urges all residents to join in recognizing the valuable contribution made by county employees dedicated to the welfare of our parks and natural resources for the benefit of our residents and visitors of La Crosse County.
Moved by Margaret Wood, seconded by Don Meyer. Discussion? John Menninger.
I just want to ask Mr. O'Malley if he read Joe Orso's column in the La Crosse Tribune yesterday on natural resources.
No, I didn't. I saw it. I meant to, yeah.
Yeah, you should. It's really interesting, but going to that last paragraph, that natural resources aren't just there for the benefit of humanity. They have
certainly.
Something. It's real interesting.
Okay,
so
yeah.
Read it.
Thank you.
Further discussion? All in favor say aye. Opposed, no. Carried unanimously.
The next items we have are actually other staff people that will be making the presentation. Mr. Chair, I'd ask if your permission, Jason Witter, Human Services Director, and his staff to present on the JDF.
Okay. Jason, if you bring your folks forward.
Okay, and who's joining me this evening? This is David Steinberg, who is the superintendent of the juvenile detention facility, and we both have parts of the presentation this evening. And what we wanted to do with the presentation tonight was to provide you all with some background and some time to discuss and answer questions with regards to changes the department is recommending with regards to the juvenile detention facility. The Health and Human Services Board is going to vote tomorrow night on some changes, and that will be before you for a decision at your meeting next Thursday. The changes that are being considered are significant. They do impact staffing, and they do impact programming at the facility, and in many ways how the facility is being used. Just as a little preface, given the budget challenges that I think all departments are facing, but the Human Services certainly is not alone there, we know it's important to take a hard look at where every county dollar is going and to make sure they're being put to optimal use. The changes we're recommending will be significant for the Human Services Department to meet our budget challenges for next year. But along with that, I would say they would be changes that we'd be recommending despite the budget environment that we're in. We're thinking this positions ourselves well to both gain some cost savings so we can preserve services in other areas of department, but also a change that will prove very good for kids as well. Okay, so in terms of... technical difficulty here.
You have to back it up.
Okay, maybe go back to the Okay, so in terms of what we'll be talking about tonight, first we just want to go over what changes are being recommended with regards to juvenile detention, why those changes are being recommended, and what impacts on the facility and kids we see as a result of those changes, and leave some time for questions and discussion. So in terms of why changes are being considered, first of all, the juvenile detention facility budget is a major piece of the Human Services Department budget. Because it's a 24/7 facility, the costs are very high. When we look at our budget for 2011, about $1.1 million in costs for the facility. And when we look at where those costs are, they're primarily in personnel. 92% of that budget is in personnel. and that includes 16.36 FTEs. That allows us to staff up to a level where we have a capacity of 26 beds we're able to serve on any given day in the facility for youth. Now, when we look at the capacity that we have in terms of 26, and we look at the utilization of the facility, the need for beds over the last decade, what we'll see is the facility on an average daily census basis each year has been about half full going back the better part of the decade. It was at its high of about 14 in 2000 and has steadily declined ever since then. There's a little bit of a bump up you'll see between 2005 and 8. That was a bit of a false bump in the sense that we had closed our shelter facility and then opened the adolescent center. So it appeared a time where those kids didn't have anywhere else to go but for secure detention. So they may have not been necessarily appropriate placements there, but that was our only option during that period. So it was really a steady decline, and looking at last year in 2010, we were at about 5 for an average daily census. But what's interesting, the facility serves both the La Crosse County youth and youth from surrounding counties that purchase beds in the facility. When we only look at the local need for this service for La Crosse County youth, you can see that that's much lower, really only half the use. So we look at that $1.1 million cost. It's really infrastructure and cost around what is a really minimal need for this type of service for La Crosse County youth. Actually, a little bit more than half of youth served in the facility have been youth from other counties. Now, the reason for the decline, just a bunch of environmental factors, but it's nothing we did as far as a change in policy in terms of utilization. In fact, what this line represents, what we're seeing here in La Crosse County, is a mirror in terms of what we've been seeing statewide in terms of use of secure detention facilities and correctional facilities. And this declining use is one of the reasons why the governor and his budget opted to close one of the juvenile correctional facilities. Just there's declining need. The state's put a lot of investment into alternative programs for youth, and with the rise of evidence-based practices, there's just really better ways where we can impact recidivism. So what we're seeing, again, is a statewide trend there. And now that becomes problematic when we see the decrease in utilization of the facility when we look at what it costs per day to serve a youth in the facility. We have fixed costs. We staff up to the same level, and we have the same operational costs, whether we have a full 26 kids in the facility or we have no kids in the facility. So as the population has gone down against those fixed costs, the average daily cost has gone up. In 2004, 2005, it was quite high, reached $572 per day per youth. We had that period of time where the population kind of artificially went up there, which drove down the cost per day a bit. But then when we were back to normal the last couple of years, in 2010, we experienced our highest per day cost to date at $656 per day. And what's troubling about this as well, when we look at, again, over half of the use of the facility has been for other counties, and then what we're able to get in for revenue from those other county placements. We our contract at the rate of $175 for each day with those other counties, which doesn't come close to covering the costs. And we really don't have much of an option for raising that contract rate, because that's right at the market level in terms of what other facilities charge. So if we raised those rates, the youth and the revenue would pretty much go elsewhere. But what this really represents, when we have all that infrastructure around very little La Crosse County need, the difference between that red line and the blue line is what La Crosse County taxpayers are subsidizing other counties for their costs of juvenile detention, which is not a very advantageous position for La Crosse County taxpayers to be in. And that $656 per day cost for the facility, just to get our arms around it. It is really a staggering cost when we look at, we always talk about youth residential placements that have a lot of clinical services around there and is a much more intensive bucket of services. And that's very costly, but those residential, which are really institutional costs that we talk about being so expensive, are really about a third of what it costs ourselves to provide a much more limited amount of services for JDF. And what we really wouldn't do, we wouldn't contract with another partner or vendor for costs that look like this. It's really unsustainable. So that's the cost factor and the decline in need, a couple of the big reasons why we're looking at this area. Now we'll talk about the changes that we're recommending to the facility. Really, two changes. The first is reduction of staffing. And really, right now, we're staffed to the 26 beds, bringing staffing down and in line with what we're seeing is the actual need of the facility. What that looks like is a reduction of 3.72 FTEs. That would allow us to maintain a capacity of at least 15 beds. And where I say at least, we would still maintain a license in the facility for 26 beds, but in terms of what ratios we'd want to maintain, we wouldn't want to go much above a use of 15 per day there. When we talk about significant savings from these options, we would save in the next year's budget on an annual basis $235,000 a year from those staffing changes. The second change is something we're pretty excited about because we're, in one hand, being able to reduce staffing, but we're really looking at this and taking advantage of an opportunity to reposition how we use the facility. We're recommending that we add an additional service track so we're able to use the facility we have to serve higher need youth that really require a longer-term stays that are currently being sent out of county at a significant cost. And that we would look at things like adding services such as counseling, alcohol and drug, and where we really have a local advantage is reintegration services to reintegrate youth back into the community. And we'll talk about both of those options in a little bit more detail, but the savings there that we estimate is an additional $190,000 of savings on an annual basis for a grand total of $425,000 next year in savings, which really helps us preserve services in other areas of the department when we're looking at categorical funding cuts next year. So now I want to turn things over to David, who's going to talk a little bit more detail with regards to the staffing impacts and the new service track we're looking at, Eddie. You have a question?
What are the ages of the kids we have there? Up to 17 or 18? Or where do we go?
10 to 17. Seventeen-year-olds are technically adults if they commit a new crime, but if they haven't committed a new crime but are still on a court order, they can stay up 218. We cannot take 18 years.
Jerry Sobranek.
Thank you. I was just going to suggest you use the mic. And what is the minimum age of the juveniles in there?
10.
Dan Ferries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many, with this reduction of roughly 10.5, a total of 10.5 people full time after it's done and said, how many people are on duty at one time?
During non-peak hours, I'll call them, there'll be two people on at one time, two staff on at one time. And during what I would call the peak period or the power time, there'll usually be three people on at one time.
And how interactive are they with the kids? Are they right in the...
Yes, yeah, so we have a direct supervision model, so they'll be right in the multipurpose area with our detained youth.
So there would always be at least two inside of the block?
Always, yes. Always two. At peak times, three.
I've just heard some concerns that, unfortunately, there are sometimes some some kids that might go to the extreme and they may try to commit suicide or hang themselves.
Correct.
And there are some concerns if those people are right there, you know, one person, what would you do? You know, you'd have right. to have assistance and you'd have to have the strength to lift and hoist, but you feel that that would be adequately staffed?
Over the last 5 years since we shut down our shelter care program, we've had three there. One person in the control booth, which is completely separate from the secure area, and two staff in the secure area with our direct supervision model. In the last 5 years, there have been less than five instances, really, where that staff person has to come out of the control booth to handle something. Most of the time, those two staff in there can handle it.
But they would if they needed to come out of the staff booth.
Yes, they would, the control booth.
Dan Meyer.
Steve O'Malley, was it budgeted for 26 beds? Is that the dollars are? When we
staffing level we've been at. We've been struggling with trying to determine various solutions over the last several years, but that's the level it's been staffed at, yes.
So we could save some money in 2011 and would be a smaller budget next year.
That's the plan, and that's what we're going to present.
Thank you.
Other questions? Ralph Geary.
Well, another way of putting this then would be with the current staffing, you could accommodate more juveniles without hiring more people?
As the presentation will show, downsizing from 26 to 15 beds will still allow for us to retain a higher number than we've been, as well as attracting potentially certain types of children that need additional types of care that's actually presented in change number two. They'll show you how this will actually impact the budget positively and also set the stage long term for the kind of treatment that we can offer.
Okay, and if we've had, let's say, empty beds for a long period of time, do we recruit in other counties that we're currently not dealing with? Or
currently, we serve any county that will use us.
Are they all Wisconsin, or do we go into Minnesota?
Minnesota, we cannot. We're not licensed for Minnesota, but they're all Wisconsin counties.
Okay, why don't you continue?
Okay, so if you look at our staffing reductions, we go from a current of 13.6, and our recommendation is to drop that staffing level down to 10.64, thus the change in 2.72 of line staff. Currently, we have 10 full-time staff, 4 part-time staff, and what we would be looking at is 6 full-time staff and 6 part-time staff. We currently have 1 standby. We would not be refilling that position, and we have 3 shift supervisors, if you will, currently, and we would be eliminating 1 shift supervisor position. And so totally right now we have 18 line staff and supervision in the JDF. And so what happens is 3 will lose a position. We've already had 1 resign. So 3 will lose a position, and that's 1 supervisor, 2 direct, and 1 standby. And then there'll be a move from full to part-time for some staff, and that will be 4. And then 10 people, they may have to change their shift. They may have to change their hours of work. But for 10 people, there will be no change. 6 full-timers will still say full-timers, and 4 part-timers will still stay part-timers. So there won't be much of a change for those folks. And so in our current track right now, we are short-term detention. That was the design that was built 21 years ago. I have been there as long as the facility has been around, and when we were built, it was for short-term detention. This is for the kids, for the safety of the community, safety of the child, safety of the family. It's also used for sanctions, hold children accountable if they're on a court order and they have a little bit of trouble following that court order. They can be held accountable by using juvenile detention. We also have For safety, we use 72-hour holds by the social workers to investigate certain violations of that court order. So that's what the whole thing was developed for 21 years ago, is safety of the community, safety of the child. But you know, your average length of stay to this day, it's always varied between 3 and 4.5 days. It's sort of hard to do any therapy or any really cognitive-based programming with a child that's only there 4.5 days. So what we're looking at is to still keep our current track, to still be able to do short-term detention to meet that need, but also add in a second track, which is a longer-term disposition. We would use that for up to 6 months. We would bring we currently keep children in Elmore Academy, Wailusing Academy, Corrections, and Eau Claire Academy for long-term stays. They do their treatment facilities. That's what they do. So, but what we're looking at doing is adding on a therapist, bringing in AODA services, plus a myriad of other services that I'll talk about in the next slide, and doing that therapy here in the community. What the nice thing about that is, you know, we send a kid to Elmore, Minnesota. I was just there touring the facility. We sent them 3 hours away, and they learn all these new tools to use to help them in their day, and then they get back into their community, and it's like, well, how do I use these tools that they've taught me in my own community? What the neat thing about what we're suggesting is these kids are right here in La Crosse learning tools to help them in their own community. They don't have to relearn things once they get back here. And so, yes, and the length of stay could be up to 6 months. And so right now what we're looking at is a four-phase program. The first phase would be the intake phase, and we would do orientation and do an assessment of needs, whether it be the LSI. I'm also looking into one of the state assessments called the Compass, which they use in the jails, but they have one for juveniles. Phase two would be therapy phase. And to mention a few, we could do individual therapy, family therapy, alcohol and drug, boys and groups and girls groups separately, so they can each deal with their own issues. We can do group therapy. We had the Mark Carey report, and he we bought this series called the Carey Guides, and I think there's 16 Carey Guides to help with all of the criminogenic needs. So we would have a social worker to be able to administer those. Cognitive-based therapy, and then we already have in place a full day of school. We have two full-time teachers and a teacher's assistant provided to us by the School District of La Crosse, so they're already doing a School District of La Crosse curriculum, and that's a big piece. So they're not really missing out on everything, because everything they do in school, they get credit for at their home school. Then we have phase three with reintegration. Now here's where we're really, you know, there's other facilities who have sort of pioneered the way for this type of programming. But where we're really going to step up and ahead is in the phase three reintegration phase. You know, we're here, we're in the community. Once they make phase three, they could go out to their own school. We could do in-home therapy. They can take care of their community service. They can go out to workforce development, which helps finding jobs. They can earn out visits. And then there's phase four, aftercare. We would be really remiss to say, okay, 6 months is done, there you go. We need to follow these kids when they're done, and we can do that by tracking, mentorship, and also independent living services. So if they're of age, in that age group, they could really benefit with independent living services.
Okay, in terms of those changes and what the operational impacts are and things like capacity and are be able to serve the youth that we expect, unit cost, coverage, which a question was asked about coverage earlier, and safety. In terms of capacity, we have our 26 beds and then our trend line since 2000. What we basically do is, again, bring down that capacity to about 15. Which is still really room to grow when we look at utilization over the last decade in terms of bringing back and keeping it in the community. Some of those youth currently sent out of county, we expect the population to go up from where it was in 2010. We expect that population to be at about 8, which still leaves us some breathing room there. in terms of costs, now that we have a facility that's less costly and more full, that will have an impact on daily cost. We'd go down from 656 to what we estimate would be 304 per day. Still pretty expensive, but what we can roll in there as well, for those kids that we're keeping in county, it's at 304, plus we're saving each day an additional $150, which is about the cost we pay for sending those youth out of county. So we get savings in a couple of ways there. In terms of impact on coverage, and you also have a handout that may show this a little clearer, but it really shows what David had talked about earlier, that right now we do have the three staff at any given time, one male, one female, and someone in the control room. Under our change coverage, again, we'd be looking at two at any given time. We'd have a supervisor on board during those power times, so we'd have those three. But we'd also be looking at some capital changes to the facility that we've worked with Jim Spiropoulos, where it'll be under $50,000, but we're going to actually move the control room more into the facility, which actually is a more interactive model that other counties are going to anyways, because you're in there able to interact more with youth. That makes that other person that's there much more useful and able to jump in if there were an incident there. And then we'd retain supervision on an irregular basis and the overnight shifts. We definitely want to have supervision there, although it wouldn't be every night. So that would be the impact on coverage. In terms of safety, and just to address that head on, when we have two individuals there at sometimes other than three, is it less safe? I guess you could say that to a degree, and if we added another person there, it may be more safe. But when we look at, are we operating within the general bounds and expectations of staff ratios and safety? What the Department of Corrections mandates in terms of a staff-to-youth ratio is one staff for every 15 youth in the facility. Our current ratio looks like it's about 1 to 1.7. And even if we were full, we would have a 1 to 8.7 ratio, which is well under those guidelines. Now, we wanted to compare this to our adolescent center because it's been raised, the youth that will be serving there that we're keeping home are going to be higher need youth. Well, we currently serve high need youth within the adolescent center, and there we have a ratio of about 1 to 8. Now, with these changes that we're recommending, we'd during those power times when there's a third person, we'd still be looking at to have a ratio about anywhere from 1 to 1.27 to 1 to 5. And during the other times, our max ratio would be 1 to 7.5. So even under the ratios that we're operating under now, well under the DOC guidelines that we think would be reasonably safe for the facility. And wanted to mention as well, David's already started a safety committee with JDF staff to look at these transitional issues to make sure we're not missing anything and making sure we're making the facility as safe as possible if we go ahead with the transition. So just to summarize the overall rationale for the changes, we're recognizing that the current staffing levels are hard to justify when we look at the diminished need over the last decade and the high costs that are involved. We're able to achieve a $425,000 savings, which is significant and extra significant when you look like we're not service is not going away. If we pulled this out of somewhere else, we'd have to look at cutting back on services. That single-track detention will still be there. And as a matter of fact, we're looking at offering a service enhancement at the same time we're reducing costs. And then finally, what we're doing is really repositioning the facility from an area that we know is a diminishing need, not only for La Crosse counties, but the counties we contract with one that we know we have a need and maybe a growing need, and in the future maybe position ourselves to open ourselves up and contract with other counties. So we think it gives the facility a bright future in terms of the types of services it offers. Just as a last-minute update, I will say as well, Counties that have been doing similar types of programs, and they include Racine and Fond du Lac counties, have been doing. There's a statute that says youth can only be in the regular secure detention for 30 days. But what local judiciary has been doing is doing what's called a technical imposed and state order for corrections to allow youth to stay longer and up to that six-month time frame. That's what we had planned on doing here, while at the same time wanted to work with other counties on a legislative change, hopefully in this budget, that would just make it much more straightforward that youth could stay in the facility for up to 6 months. We had good local bipartisan support for that. We worked with other counties, and I'm happy to say the Joint Finance Committee did approve that change, which sets us up well. The new law, if there's no veto of that, will allow us to keep youth up to 6 months, provided there's some of the programming like AODA, some of the things that we're already planning on providing anyway. So we were really happy to have that change. So again, in terms of next steps, the board, Health and Human Services Board, will officially decide on this direction tomorrow. And if approved, we'll come back to you next Thursday for a decision there. In terms of time frames, which is important, we're looking and need a full year of savings with the new programming, and that's what gets us over the $400,000. But we want the transition to that to be smoothly, so we'll be recommending that the staffing changes go into effect in October. So we have a three-month period of time where we're able to operate comfortably under the new staffing levels and make that transition before we bring higher need youth in the facility and implement the programming. So that's the time frames that at least be recommended in the decision that's coming before the Health and Human Services Board tomorrow. So any questions and discussion?
Questions or discussion? Audrey Cotter.
Thank you. It's a fine presentation, and it looks like a very well thought out transitional plan, good for the youth. One thought that crossed my mind is with the reduction in staffing, are these represented employees or not? And how can you handle, I'm sure you've probably addressed that to some degree, but
yeah, I mean, of the three positions that would be losing a position, two of them are represented and one is not. And we've been working pretty aggressively already, and Administrator O'Malley has been super supportive in trying to find other positions within the county for these individuals. Some of them have a lot of longevity with JDF, and we really want to treat them right in the transition. So we've already started to do some of the planning, if this comes to fruition, to do that.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Chuck Spiker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When will this take effect? 1 October, did you say?
And we're looking at October 1st in terms of being down to the new staffing levels, okay, and then January 1st in terms of the programming and being able to bring some of the youth back to the county.
Savings from October to December, are you going to use that money where?
And, well, that depends on in terms of how our out-of-home care budget is looking and elsewhere at the end of the year. If we have savings, so some of that is returned to the general fund or goes against us not having to use so much of our fund balance. So that stays within the county in some fashion.
This helps assure that the juvenile detention facility will come in as budgeted. It's been a very difficult struggle the last several years, so we'll certainly report that back during budget as we prepare, but we've struggled to hit the mark for controlling of costs in JDF over the last several years.
But it wouldn't go back to general fund.
No,
it
would go to Human Services
Fund.
Right. Fund balance, right.
Okay. The JDF started 21 years ago, and I happened to be on the board then, and there was a discussion, and things have changed in 21 years. I support the plan. I think it's a good plan. But one selling point was that we'd always get more from other counties in collaboration. And 21 years later, it's probably happening. But that was a selling point for the staff at that time, was to get other counties. First, we asked them to help contribute. Oh, no. That's all changed now, because that was 21 years ago. Now they find out through the leadership of the chair and the administrator that they have to have collaboration. That's the smoothest and easiest way and probably cheapest way for them to go. So I support the plan completely. Thank you.
Don Bina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question in regards to, you say that the majority are coming, of the kids are coming from out county rather than our county. And you talked about where we're going in the future. And then you're going to hire people, and I'm assuming they're going to be hired from us here in the county. But is that necessary? Because if the majority of kids are going to be receiving follow-up in other counties, are we going to be sending our staff and paying mileage to Trempealeau, Jackson, Clark, wherever they're coming from? Have you got a cost figure in on that, or are we going to show other counties how they can take care of their own kids once they get back into their own system?
Okay, good question. And actually, the second track that we'll be adding, we're anticipating and cost it out for next year of only being La Crosse County youth that we'd be serving with that second track. We think that there's a potential in the future that other counties will be interested in that, and then we'd want to set a cost that actually cover our costs, but we don't want to move in that direction until we really make sure we have it right.
John Menninger.
A couple quick questions. Are all the employees of the juvie, I always want to say juvie jail, but JDF, human service employees? None of you are under the sheriff's department, are you?
No, we're all human services.
And then my other question is, you know, obviously there's bad kids, but it's my experience that there's an awful lot of bad homes. So for a reintegration of the kid back into the house, I mean, you just put the kid back in the house, he's going to have the same kind of problems. That's where that family therapy comes into play, that you work with the environment that they're coming out of?
Yep, in the therapy phase, I spoke about family therapy, and that would be at the center. That would be there one-on-one with the therapist. But then once we get to the reintegration phase, that's where we're doing in-home. That's where we're working in the home with the parents and that family.
And then I know foster care has all kinds of problems too, but if you don't get cooperation, or if you think the environment hasn't changed and you're going to have the recidivism, then would you then make a recommendation to move the kid into foster care then? Is that part of this too, or...?
I would hope so. At this point, I'm not the person that's going to be in there. And we're looking, right now we're looking, as I said, you know, we're looking at a therapist and having AODA, but we're also within the plan looking at having at least a half-time of our own county social worker allocated to this. And that would be the person that would make that kind of decision.
Because these are usually very complicated situations.
Oh, yeah.
For a lot of these kids.
But that is a very good point. Now, the direction this is moving is very consistent with the philosophy of the Criminal Justice Management Council. And you're right, traditional juvenile justice practice really looked at the youth as an offender and really dealt with that youth. But specifically what we've been seeing with the youth that are sent out of county may do very well in that setting. Get a lot of reports. They're doing fantastic. The date comes to return home, and then they really blow up in that facility. And the reason why is they really don't want to return back to their home environment. And so, all too often, unfortunately, therapeutic work hasn't been done with the family from the time that the youth has left. So the practice is much more going towards looking at the family unit as a whole, not just the juvenile. And you're right, making a decision as well. Is this going to be a good permanency option to go back to that family, or do we need to look at another permanency option? So this fits in nicely with that.
John, you're touching on something that's really critical to this whole interaction, and this is actually part of our family and children's unit. Nancy Pullman, our new director of that area, is very integrally involved in how that programming can happen, how the social workers are involved. The extension to up to 6 months will be very critical to be able to work clearly with the revised JDF and the type of programming that's happened. So it's more than just the two individuals that are presenting today. It's the entire concept of what we're doing to control long-term out-of-home placement costs, what we're doing to try to deal with the family issues at the same time. And, of course, Wade Anger's position that is vacant and being filled will end up being a key part of that transition in what Family and Children as a unit wants to do with these kids, and making it more than just a set-aside for the 4.5 days, a longer period of time that's actually integrated with the types of programming that they're doing. So it's really well thought out, as I've witnessed from staff bringing it forward.
I know that under the current arrangement, we charge parents per day, although I know collection is problematic. Under the second track, will parents be charged any fees?
We're still looking at that right now. The agency is charging parents right now for a child in out-of-home placement is the child support percentage. So I would assume that for in-county parents, that would be the child support percentage.
Okay. Marilyn Pedretti.
Thank you. First of all, thank you, David. I took him up on an offer to tour the facility this afternoon. I'm a visual person. It helps for me to see it, and I appreciate you taking the time and recommend it to other board members. During that tour, you explained a little bit of why those numbers are going down. Could you maybe help us understand? You had a 26-bed capacity at one point. Now you're thinking 14 is plenty. Could you help explain that?
It goes back a while, and again, this speaks to my longevity. When we opened the facility in 1990, there was only 15 beds in the facility. By the early to mid-90s, about 93, we were experiencing huge growth in there from other counties and our own county as well. We petitioned the state and got a variance to add another 11 beds to double bunk. By the mid-90s, now we're into Columbine, and the public sentiment had changed. It locked them up. Any little thing, lock these kids up. And, you know, we had kids on the floor. We had kids everywhere. But by 2000, 2001, public sentiment started to come down. You know, money is a little different, and our numbers just, you know, now we're, what, 15 years, 14 years post-Columbine, and the numbers are going down. Plus, also, it's an expense to counties. There's a lot of counties out there, and we do serve every county. Any county who wants to use us will bend over backwards to serve you. But there are counties out there that absolutely say, no secure juvenile detention. It's too expensive. We need to spend our resources elsewhere. So that's sort of a brief history of the ups and downs of JDF.
I appreciate that. Thanks again.
Ray Ebert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about the cost. You're anticipating it'll go down to $306 a day or roughly there. Then you mentioned something about another 150. That 150 is for the second track. So that does that go to 450 per day then, or am I missing something?
Nope, that $150 still the cost will be the $300 per day, but there's an additional 150 for those kids that we're serving under that new track. That we're saving by serving them in La Crosse. Otherwise, if we sent those kids elsewhere, we'd be paying $150 a day while still having the fixed cost of our facility.
So when we send someone out, it's costing us roughly $450 a day?
Yeah, and it's $150 a day when we use that figure for Elmore Academy in Minnesota, where a lot of these kids will be brought back from. So we'll be saving that every day in addition to having a lower facility cost.
Okay, so it's $150 a day to send someone out of the county. It's going to be $300 if we keep them, and just, you know, as thing, aren't we better off to send them all out of the county at $150
yeah.
a day?
In a sense, we'd be paying that $300 regardless, because we'd have the same infrastructure in place unless we close the facility. Actually, the staffing reductions that we're recommending are really the minimum staffing that we can operate with the facility, because necessitating having one male and one female on at all times. So we'd have those costs regardless. The difference is we're using staff and programs we're already paying for instead of sending them out and paying additional dollars.
Correct. No, but as a devil's advocate, for strictly cost, we'd be better off to close the facility down and send folks out at $150 a day?
At a strict dollar amount, I understand your point. The difficult thing is that $300 a day is the short-term placements, the 4.5 So you'd have all kinds of transportation. You'd be going back and forth between either Eau Claire or Madison as the two closest facilities. So you'd have $300 a day or whatever they were charging plus all the transportation. So you wouldn't save all of that. The other thing is that in Track 2, we are paying the $150 a day for Elmore, but it's a different type of programming. JDF is a different type of programming than what we're going to be able to target into our own facility. So it's like picking up a new set of customers, places that were already there. So yes, you could save a lot more by just completely getting out of the business, but then you would never have any of the community reintegration. You'd never have the added needs that this type of Track 2 would be able to provide, as well as the population will go back up because now we're offering a different level of service. We can potentially attract some of the surrounding counties that are also sending to Elmore that are closer and offer a different level of service. We've been in touch with a number of the surrounding counties that are interested in this kind of level of service if we get it organized correctly. This again is about a 40% savings over what we currently have. We've invested in time, staffing, physical plant, and so instead of just saying the whole thing is done and we're going to start over from scratch, we're trying to basically make, for lack of a better analogy, lemonade out of lemons and get the most cost effective that we can. And this is a conservative projection. If we get this level of programming and with that statutory change that Jason just talked about, I think we're going to be well positioned for this region to actually see better costs because we'll be able to offer a different level of programming than Dave and his staff have ever been able to do. At that 4.5 day average length of stay, you just can't offer the level of programming that we're going to build up to. So I think you're going to see better results. And again, initially about a 40% change in the actual cost of this operation.
And what effect, and you were very kind to show me through several months ago, is there any effect on the non-secure side of your business?
In my estimation, no.
So in other words, someone couldn't graduate from the secure side and go to the non-secure side?
They could, and we've talked about that. We could use the non-secure as a step down process,
I mean,
depending
that just
on where
seems,
it could.
We talk about continuums, that seems to make
sense. Yep, absolutely.
And the last question is, why did it take us so long to come to this? Why didn't we do this last year or 2 years ago? I don't understand why now and not 1 year or 2 years ago.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, it's not fair for Mr.
No,
Witt.
No, yeah, before Jason was here, and frankly with Dave and Jerry Huber, we've been examining what options we've had for 24 to 36 months. The difficult thing is that this is not a situation that's been stable. It looks stable when you look at the graph right now, but with all the changes that we've made to the non-secure facility, the whole debate about what happens with juveniles. Are we going to change and close down the requirements of who can be in the secure jail? There have been a number of different fluctuations, and Dave has actually looked at several different options. I think there was originally six or seven different variations of this, including trying to actually recruit other counties that we had lost as customers to come back. It's easy to say now, why didn't we do this? But it's taken that long a period of time to really look at all of these options and combine everything from the Track 2, what we're talking about, the Elmore kind of situation, as well as the volatility of what happens with juveniles. How many people remember the debate we've had for several years about whether or not we're going to change the age of juveniles in the secure jail? We've had significant lobbying on that. No money to pay for it, but the legislature has been debating whether or not to do that. Had we downsized and just gotten out of the business and the state had changed that, we'd have to start over from scratch. So it's easier to say now, why didn't we change that? But we've been examining every option we've had for well before Jason's arrival. This is really coming to the culmination of, this is something we have to do now. The trend line isn't changing, but we need to have enough extra level of service to be able to meet another level of need that we're contracting out that isn't meeting the community's needs. So this is the summary, really, of at least 24 months' worth of work, is what you're seeing here.
Thank you very much.
Maureen Friedland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I wanted to ask the question about 17-year-olds. I'm glad that Mr. O'Malley brought that up. I did ask at the Family Policy Board this afternoon if 17-year-olds could get those kind of services, and the answer was no, because they're automatically considered to be adults and they go into jail. But I wonder if there are circumstances of working with judges in particular cases or anything like waivers or something like that that could keep the 17-year-olds there, because clearly this is the kind of programming that 17-year-olds should be having rather than going into the jail system. And I also wanted to ask the question, what is the cost of a 17-year-old, this is a rhetorical question, what is the cost of a 17-year-old in this facility or as opposed to being in jail per day? Do you know the answer to that?
The cost between a juvenile in our facility as opposed to the jail?
Yeah.
Quite a bit more.
Right.
Quite a bit more.
Okay.
And again, it all comes down to staffing levels. Over there, I think they're, Mr. O'Malley, 1 to 30, 1 to 60, you know, we're 1 to 7 or 8. As far as 17-year-olds being able to, there'd be a very small window to work with 17-year-olds. If they've committed a new crime, now they're an adult. We've all know this. But if there was a 17-year-old that was still on a court order, a juvenile court order, and still in the juvenile system, we could work with that juvenile. But again, most of the time when these juveniles commit new crimes, they're over in the jail, and it's sort of over. You very rarely get juveniles under, 17-year-olds under a juvenile court order. So,
Vicki Burke.
Just a question. You talked about the closing of facilities. Did they are they anticipating then closing Ethan Allen or Lincoln Hills?
They're closing Ethan Allen and Southern Oaks.
Okay.
And they're going to put all of them together up at Lincoln Hills. Everything is going to be combined into one facility.
That's not a good situation, is it?
Well, I don't know. I can speak to you. Myself and Dean Rupert toured Southern Oaks in November. There was 18 girls there. It's built on 120 model. Okay. We met with 11 social workers, 14 teachers, 20-some line staff, 10, 15 cooks. And we're talking 30, 40 staff to 18
sure.
girls. So.
I was thinking
it's about
of
time.
Lincoln Hills and Ethan Allen. Ethan Allen was more of a rural facility, wasn't it? And Lincoln Hills.
Lincoln Hills is very rural. Lincoln Hills is the one that's out in the middle of a swamp up north,
okay.
And Ethan Allen is right
confused.
Outside of Milwaukee.
Okay, I have them confused. Yeah. So they're closing?
The one right outside Milwaukee.
Okay, thank you.
Bill Feehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to mention that in the initial presentation to the Board of Health that one of the possibilities is that we just close the juvenile detention facility, and that saves about $750,000 a year. I don't think that this is what we want in our community. These are essential services for youths, and so what I see here is a middle approach that's responsible to taxpayers, that tries to reduce the costs, and it's also very creative. It's tapping into the same type of ideas that have succeeded before with a regional approach. And so I would mention that there were questions about the costs involved. I believe there will be additional cost savings that haven't been factored in because we won't be sending social workers on a two-hour drive to a remote area. We mentioned the benefits of bringing the kids back locally for this treatment, and my anticipation is that after they get the local treatment program up and running, that we're going to see that the eight counties in our area are going to start to send kids here, and that's a better outcome for them as well. And so I am sure that this plan will be approved at tomorrow night's Board of Health meeting, and I commend everyone on their work for this. I think this is showing real leadership in La Crosse County, and I'll mention that I lobbied Senator Kopanky's office to make sure that we got that six-month extension to hold these kids, and I believe Jill Billings did some lobbying too. So I think this is a real win for La Crosse County. It keeps the level of services that we're providing to our youths at a very high level, and it's forward thinking, and I just commend everybody involved.
Sharon Hampson.
I just had a couple other details. One of the things that we were waiting on and waiting and waiting and waiting were what state institutions were going to close. It took a long, long time, and it spanned two different administrations, and the staff at the state is continually changing jobs. So that took, that in itself took a long time. And at one point, we invited some of the state people here and asked how we could become part of the state system using our JDF. And so we've tossed around an awful lot of stuff.
Don Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave, you indicated earlier that we didn't deal with Minnesota counties because we're not licensed there. Yet I hear you say that we send kids to Elmo Academy, and that's in Minnesota. So I don't quite get the mix.
I'll give you a little history. This is another thing that we've been working towards. About in 2006, 2007, in our statute that regulates us, Chapter 938, it says that Wisconsin counties can contract with Minnesota counties for juvenile detention. So I started looking down that track and working with their DOC. Their bar is a lot higher, and we would have had upwards of 57 variances that we would have had to have meet, number one, just to meet their code. Number two, which was very cost prohibited, by the way. Number two, in working with Fillmore, Houston, and Winona, thank you, counties, we're the closest. They'd love to bring their kids here, but all of their DAs are worried about reciprocity. They're worried about having to, if a kid says, I don't want to go back to Minnesota, you know, now how are we going to get them back? So they were really worried about that. So, I mean, it was heavily studied and heavily looked at and heavily talked about, but at the end, it just it was another one of our roadblocks to how we're getting to here.
I wouldn't want to go back to Minnesota either, but. So when you get through Elmore. Tell us about it. What's there? Therapy and that type of thing? Or?
Elmore, Minnesota. There's not much there. There's 625 people, birthplace of Walter Mondale. It's an old school they built dormitories around it. It's a residential facility for kids. And they can hold kids up to a year. They do have to go through Interstate Compact to get over there, but once the Interstate Compact paperwork is done, they send kids over there. And while it may, it's about a 3-hour drive, it's a good facility, and in our mind, it's pretty fiscally responsible. They charge $150 a day, which if you think about residential treatment, that's pretty cheap. It really is. So that's pretty much why they use it. Plus, it's out of the community. Some of these kids really need to get out of the community. So instead of sending them to corrections, which is almost $300, this is about half.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Jill Billings.
I'd just like to talk a little bit about the history in response to Supervisor Ebert's question. Jerry Huber said that as rates for incarceration of juveniles or sending them to a facility got higher, suddenly the youth in the surrounding counties got better, and they were no longer needed to be sent to La Crosse. Now, the good side of that is that people were looking at alternatives, as we already were, to locking kids up, as we were doing with our adults. We were looking at that philosophy with our kids, using other programs that were more appropriate for some kids. So we were hit with that, and staff tried a lot of different ways over the last few years to address those issues, like looking at maybe bringing our rates down and looking at economies of scale and talking with our surrounding counties. But the other factor is that some other people have facilities too. And so there was kind of a bidding war out there, as there were less youth that were going to facilities. And so staff tried to deal with that issue. We have been working, as Supervisor Feehan said, we have been working with the legislature on several issues, including the 17-year-olds, not automatically waiving them into adult court. We've been advocating on behalf of closing one of the facilities, and we did not specify Ethan Allen. We left it up to a study that was being done, because there was a lot of expense and not enough juveniles also in those facilities. Our numbers were going down in those facilities, and we suggested that to the state as a cost-saving advice through WCA. For several years, we've we've advocated for that, and we're happy to see that they took care of that this year. It looks like they will. So staff was working on this, and supervisors were working on this, and I think we've ended up with a program that is, in the long run, really good, where we're looking at the therapy component, the reintegration component, the aftercare component, as we are with our adults. And part of that was having the CARI group come and do a sort of a mini report on our juvenile system. And so we're using elements of that. And I think that we're trying to do the best we can by staff, and I think that this is something that's been coming. So I can't imagine that would be a surprise to people that we have to change. We have to change something. We've been looking at options, and I think we've ended up with a good system that will provide better programming, will keep our youth in our community, and will be more cost-effective.
That's all the names I have on the list, so thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate the informative report.
Thank you.
Okay, next item, Mr. O'Malley.
Next item, we have a report from Jeff Buskey and Charlie Handy on the zoning ordinance update.
Thank you, Mr. O'Malley. I guess we're Z for a reason, or the end of the alphabet. I, too, would like to thank the county board for doing something a few years back, and that's hiring a county planner. If you guys remember me talking about this, I had a long laundry list of things to do, but nobody to assign it to. And we found a very fine assignment here, the creation of this new zoning code. I'd like to direct your attention to the two maps over there, and maybe if we could pull this one out and get it over in the middle of the room. La Crosse County encompasses about 500 square miles. And this is for mainly supervisors 18 through 35 right now, because that ordinance affects you. This does not affect the cities and villages, but it does have a direct impact on their quality of life. About 80% of the land shown in La Crosse County has only 20% of the population. If you look at the lime green map on the right up there, the areas in white hold about 80% of the population. That's only about 20% of the land. So if you take a look at that 80% that we're dealing with about 400 acres that are affected by this rewrite of our zoning code. 400,000, I should say. So your ordinance right now, Chapter 17, is the zoning ordinance. That has been in place since 1952 with some amendments. This board adopted Chapter 31, which was the county's comprehensive plan. That was done in March of 2008, mainly from directives that came from the state statutes that indicated it was time for all counties and municipalities to do this work. So, with the help of this county board, the county board formed a 14 committee member to put the comprehensive plan together. And that's why we're here right now. Those 14 members, along with a lot of citizen input, indicated it was time to amend the county zoning ordinance. So there were some issues in the last chapter in the comprehensive plan that indicated there are things that we want to see implemented, things that aren't in the ordinance right now, and you're going to hear about that. Portions of the office, we've got different divisions in the Zoning, Planning, Land Information Office. This division happens to deal with zoning and planning and the issues of consistency with the county plan. You're going to hear how we are consistent with the plan and how we're trying to make the zoning ordinance consistent with the county plan, because the state statutes indicate that every single action this board takes, any municipality takes, has to be consistent with that plan. However, that definition doesn't indicate if you have to be consistent 100% of the time or 80% of the time. Our job is to keep everybody on the same page that we're trying to keep things that are consistent, because as soon as you start deviating from the plan, you start to get disorder. We have probably worked since the comprehensive plan was put in place in March of 2008. We started working and look at it in different areas of the county zoning ordinance to improve. We met with a lot of the local municipalities. We met with Corporation Council, because you'll see in the analysis portion that Corporation Council will be doing for you when this is done, that they help draft the ordinance and put it in legal words after we've done our homework. Staff has probably got over 300 hours in this. Along with the comprehensive plan, I would too like to estimate that we probably saved the county over $300,000 by doing this in-house and not hiring this out to a consultant, because we feel that we probably have better input. We know what's broken and what has to be fixed. And to tell a consultant that same thing and then have them bring it back is kind of useless for us. So you're going to see in here, based on some charts, you've got some handouts, and you're going to see a real brief PowerPoint on this. Charlie's going to do the meat of this, but we also have Nathan Sampson. He's your zoning supervisor. He'll be here to answer any questions, and when Charlie's done, I'm going to wrap this up with some other comments. So, Charlie?
I made a few copies of the ordinance on CD. If anybody wants one, raise your hand.
Does anybody want one right now?
It's on the web. We can email it to you, whatever you want. What I'm going to focus on tonight is this handout that's on your that's pretty colors, nice pastels. You'll also notice the left map over there, that's our existing zoning ordinance. Wonderfully effective, but not the best looking map in the world. Cartography wise, the right one is a little bit easier to read, a little bit simpler, and maybe the colors are a little bit better. But also, they're also more consistent with the comprehensive plan. So any of the yellowish colors, even a little into the orange, those are residential. The greenish colors are ag and natural resources. Pink and black are industrial and commercial. And blue are public. So it keeps it fairly simple. If you're looking at the comprehensive plan, what are the future land uses? If you're looking at the zoning ordinance, what are the zoning districts? To try and simplify and clarify. And that's truth in advertising is kind of the theme of what we've been doing for those 300 plus hours. So zoning ordinance rewrite, if you see the slide that's up there, table 9.1 is the action plan for the county's comprehensive plan. And one of the actions in table 9.1 was to do a comprehensive rewrite of the La Crosse County Zoning Code and an update of the sign regulations in the zoning code, who is responsible listed there. And then the schedule was to complete that in the year 2008. We apologize for not completing it in 2008. This is something that when I started in August of 2002, we started working on. We really started to set up the rewrite of this ordinance, you know, even before I was hired. So it's something that we've been working on for a long time. Mike Weibel retired in the middle of the process. I don't know if it's part of why he retired or. This is statutory language. The board may, by a single ordinance, repeal an existing county zoning ordinance and reenact. That's what we're trying to do. This is also statutory language. This is an issue that you will probably have discussions about over the next year and a half. We have 12 towns in La Crosse County. All of those towns currently have adopted the countywide zoning ordinance. At the time of a comprehensive rewrite of a zoning ordinance by a county, the towns will have the opportunity to opt out. In many other counties across the state of Wisconsin, they amended their zoning ordinance on a piecemeal basis, a little part here, a little part there, so that their towns didn't have this opportunity. as a staff, and I believe, you know, as strong direction from you as a county board, we have a lot more respect for our towns. And we feel that they should have the ability to take a look at this comprehensive rewrite and opt out if they feel that's a good decision for their town to make. And so that's a very important discussion that's going to happen over the next several months is, are there towns that want to opt out of this? We currently have a very good program in place where 12 towns work with the county to do zoning. So what are the things that the town might think about when they're looking at this comprehensive rewrite? Should they stay under the county zoning by approving the revision? Should they opt out by creating their own ordinance, or do neither and end up with nothing? So these are some of the questions the town should consider. What's the town's ability to afford and administer a local zoning code? What's the town's willingness to accept the responsibilities? And what could they gain? They should consult their town attorney or our county court person counsel with some of these questions. Towns that opt out will continue to be subject to county shoreland, floodplain, and wetland zoning regulations. And as they are now, each zoning amendment, each map amendment also must be reviewed by the county. So whether they're in countywide zoning or not, they're still in countywide zoning. If they do their own administration, they do their own zoning changes, it still gets reviewed here at the county level. Does the politics of the approval stay the same? Probably not. There's probably some changes in the politics if they opt out, but the process is basically the same. So this is that. Boy, that's awful. I apologize. The colors are bad. This is that sheet, and I guess you'll probably have to look at your sheet on your desk. This is really the heart of the presentation. The new zoning districts are over here on the my right, I guess it would be, as you're looking at it, your left, the new zoning district name. And then on the far side would be your right are the names of the districts that are existing now that they would be replacing. So if you look at that, we're not changing a ton. It's fairly similar. Residential District A is replacing Residential District A. Res B, Res B, Res C, Res C. So those are all the same. The Agricultural District A that we know of today, that's the gray colors on the map on the left, will be changed to Rural Residential. And again, this is truth in advertising. Ag A has really not been agriculture for most of the county. It's been Rural Residential. With a minimum lot size of a half an acre, typically those have developed as residential. Now, the only real exception to that is in the town of Madary, who never adopted exclusive ag zoning. So everything in Madary was either Ag A or something else. It was never exclusive or transitional. So there are some large farms in Madary that are zoned Ag A. Those farms will have the ability to rezone to the new zoning district in the middle of the green, which is called general agriculture. Okay, exclusive ag replaces exclusive ag, same thing. General agriculture replaces the ag district called transitional agriculture. And general agriculture is just more accurate in its definition. The requirements are basically the same. And then recreational and natural resources is a new name for an old district. The old district was called Ag District B. What did Ag District B mean? It meant not a lot. Recreational and natural resources is a little bit more descriptive of what goes on in Ag District B. The next in the red, the commercial district covers what used to be commercial districts A and B. And the reason for that is commercial district A is a very light commercial retail district. And what do we have, about 5 acres of that in the county? Why? There's been no demand for it. So we just basically closed those two districts into one district called commercial. Now the light industrial district, which is currently called commercial district C. And if you remember, there was a little flack a couple years back about a small asphalt plant that discussed this commercial district C and why it wasn't called an industrial district. And that's, you know, one of the reasons for these changes is because we've seen problems with the old zoning code as far as some of these descriptions and uses and things like that. So light industrial is more descriptive of actually what's happening in that district. And then there's the industrial district, which is the same as the industrial district. We have a bunch of mobile home courts in La Crosse County, 15. Does that sound right? I look at Nate. He just nods his head. Yeah, that's right. This is Marilyn. How many times have we done this presentation? I don't have a good memory. It's just repetition beats it into my head. So the mobile home courts will actually be changed to what's called a manufactured home community. We have a new definition for what a mobile home has become, which is now a manufactured home. There's federal definitions that we're using. At the same time, this manufactured home community also significantly places the burden of enforcement back on the landowner. We have residents in these mobile home courts that have a poor quality of life because it's hard to enforce on an absentee landowner. That's our biggest issue with mobile home courts is one of the residents in the mobile home court can put up, you know, a number of different little garden sheds, maybe not even on area that he's supposed to own, or not own, but rent, and there's very little enforcement on that. Maybe a deck goes up, and the deck covers half of the neighbor's lot, and it's really difficult to get to those issues. So this manufactured home community district really places the burden of enforcement on the landowner, and if the landowner doesn't do enforcement, we have a few more tools to be able to encourage that landowner to do better enforcement. And then the last district, the blue district, is something we don't have now. Public facilities and institutional, we've always put them in conditional uses or in a different district, and it's just harder to find on a map where the town hall would be located, where a park is, where a public facility might be located, and so that blue should stick out a little bit better on the map. And then the uses are just consistent with the uses in the current zoning districts. So that's the big changes that we've made. I guess probably the things that you will hear and that we will hear at the public hearings are the changes we've made to the Ag A district, to rural residential. That significant change really came as a recommendation to us from the town of Campbell, where there's a lot of multifamily buildings that are built in the Ag A district. Well, if you look at that map and you look at all of the gray on that map, right now, multifamily is an allowed use, and there is a lot of concern out there from property owners that have invested in a single-family home or a duplex that a large multifamily building could get built next door to them tomorrow, and that's the truth. It could, and so that concern came up over time and time again in our comprehensive planning process. So what we've done is we've made multifamily a conditional use in the Ag A district, which is now called rural residential. That you might get some flack on that issue. The public may not be thrilled about losing what may be perceived as a property right to do multifamily in Ag A, but that's really what the public has told us, is that's a fear of theirs rather than something that they think is a benefit. And so that's one of the biggest drafting changes that we've made. Secondly, a big drafting change is in the exclusive ag zoning district. Currently, in the exclusive ag zoning district, you can build a house for your son, daughter, parent, or employee. And if you have 15 kids, you can build 15 houses. What we've seen over the past 30 years with farmland preservation in place is a significant amount of people kind of working that loophole. They'll build a house for their son and sell it, build a house for their son and sell it, build a house for their son and sell it. Well, you only got one son. How does that work? It's a problem because that was really in there to keep farm families together. You want the children or the employees to stay on the farm, to keep that farm unit together as an operating business. And that's a good, very positive thing for our agricultural community. So we don't want to lose that loophole. But yet there's a significant amount of abuse. We have to take care of that. And so the state, through the Working Lands Initiative, adopted in the 2009 biennial budget, the Working Lands Initiative. And the Working Lands Initiative caps those residential units on a base farm tract at a maximum of 5 lifetime. And that number came up basically through quite a bit of statistical analysis. An average family doesn't have 5 kids.
You've never been average, though, Charlie.
Okay, some of you know me, and that's why that's okay, inside joke. Anyway, that number of 5 is really a lifetime number of residential development on the farm to keep the farm family and farm unit together. If that farm should develop more residential units than that, they still have the ability to amend the comprehensive plan and to amend the zoning to a residential development standard or density. So it doesn't limit their ability to develop residential homes on the farm long term if there's a change in the plan and a change in the development structure at the farm. So that's where the number 5 comes from, and I think through quite a bit of we've been through quite a bit of scrutiny on these issues, and it's really held up to that scrutiny. So the number five is something that we're fairly comfortable with at this point. We've also talked about this issue and felt that we needed a little bit more flexibility for our farmers in La Crosse County. And so we came up with a proposal to allow 3% of that farm to be rezoned to the rural residential district if they don't have any of those conditional uses for that five farm family residences. And so those that 3%, let's say it's a 200-acre farm, they could rezone 6 acres without amending the comprehensive plan. That gives that ag landowner the ability to bring in a little bit of income from the development of that small 3% parcel. They put it on an area that doesn't have a negative impact on the farm, and they can develop the lot sizes. In both of those cases, there's no minimum lot size. And the problem before was there was a 35-acre minimum lot size, and you take 35 acres out of the middle of a farm, that really hinders the ability of that farm to operate continually as an effective large agricultural operation. So these minimum lot sizes are now down to half an acre from 35 acres. So I think that's an improvement that we heard from the comprehensive planning process, is that the 35-acre minimum lot size was just not working to save farmland. And a lot of that stuff comes through us from the state through the Working Lands Initiative, but also like the 3% flexibility comes as a kind of a well-beaten path through the staff that have come up with a process working with the towns to find that additional flexibility. All right. This is the analysis page that our Corporation Council office did for the zoning ordinance, and I would highly recommend that you read it because Dave did a wonderful job on it. It tells you everything you need to know, and if I would have followed this, I'd be done by now. You wouldn't still be listening to me talk. So it's a real nice executive summary of what's in the ordinance for you. I think I can. We've sent out a number of communications to the towns. We met with the towns on a regular basis in 2008 and 2009 out at the library in West Salem or at the West Salem Village Hall to talk to them about this draft. Yeah, I did say 2008, 2009. It's now 2011. Anyway, we've also been to, I think, at least 7 or 8 of the quarterly towns unit meetings and given presentations and requested input on the ordinance. And then in April, I sent a letter to all of the town chairs asking that they schedule public informational meetings at their towns during June and July. At this point, understanding that they're very busy, they just went through an election, we haven't heard back from 7 of the 12 towns on scheduling those meetings. I had hoped to have them scheduled for you here tonight. It just hasn't happened. But these are the schedules that we have for you. I'll be up to Marilyn's place tomorrow night with their Town of Holland Plan Commission giving a presentation. It'll be briefer than this one, they hope, and talk to them about the zoning ordinance. And we'll have a map specifically for the Town of Holland. And residents there can take a look at the map in a much bigger scale on a very personal level with us and take a look at what the map looks like, the future map. You can see the changes, which are basically just in color between the two maps, but to make sure that we get the zoning districts correct for any residents that come to those public informational meetings. We will also hold a public hearing at the county level. I'm hoping in September, August or September, to try and get this ordinance adopted sometime later this year. At the same time, we also have to get certification by the state because it is a farmland preservation zoning ordinance, and we're drafting the farmland preservation plan to get the certification on that plan at the same time. So I guess that's it for me.
But all I have to add is, how do we get people to come to these regional these town meetings? I'm kind of a history buff. I was following something that's been happening down in Crawford County. It's a meeting about a well, draws a large crowd. Over 100 people attended a packed town hall meeting in Utica. This is over somebody's request to put in a pump that would pump 500,000 gallons of water a day, and they say that they weren't going to bottle it. but there was talks about bottling it. Now, if we could come up with something like this that would indicate there's going to be a landfill or something in one of these communities, we'd probably end up packing the place.
Probably if the chairman bought beer. Chairman of that committee.
So, to help out, I have another handout, and it's sitting on your desk. Let me just get my copy here. Called the Public Participation Plan. And if you look about two-thirds of the way down on that document, it indicates who's responsible for implementation of this. And we put the Board of Supervisors here, all of you, number one, the La Crosse County Planning Resources and Development Committee, and naturally our department. Now, I'm indicating that everybody shares a responsibility for amending this ordinance, because it's ultimately the county board that will decide on the direction and the content of this document. Now, when we get this to the final stage, after all the public input, two things are going to happen. You're going to approve text. We're going to have a new ordinance. It's going to throw out, it's going to repeal the old ordinance, and the new one is going to come and stand up. But the map, every single month, you guys hear individual map amendments come in. It's for one parcel. We're going to be changing the map as well. We're going to flip, and that's a term that you probably didn't hear in this conversation yet. We're going to flip from the dark brown map to the lime green map. We're going to have some new districts to deal with. So we want the people to become very aware of this terminology that we're using now. Transitional ag is gone. Agricultural District B is gone. Commercial A and B is gone. Try and promote this, please. Please help us out. And the second or the last page, there's a comment page. I've had some supervisors come up to me and say, how can we get people to participate? People don't like to come to meetings. It's very evident. But the ones that do like to provide input, make copies of this, if that's okay, Mr. Chairman, and then have them send them to us. We'll field these comments, because a lot of people feel better just about putting a comment down on paper and mailing the thing in. So I guess, Mr. Chairman, that's all I have.
Questions, comments? Audrey Cotter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is in relation to Charlie's presentation. And the blue at the end, which is the public facilities and institutional, when I look at the authorized uses, many of those appear to be ones that generally are in residential districts. So how are you suggesting that churches, schools, libraries, those three in particular, would become no new ones would be allowed within residential districts because they're not listed for conditional uses?
Go ahead.
The new ones would be allowed if we don't have any new ones mapped. There's no vacant parcels that are mapped for public facilities and institutional. That would need to be approved by the county board for a new area of that zoning district for a new church, a new library, a new school in a specific location. So they're mapping the existing facilities, and then if there's a request for a new one, that would come before you as a rezoning request.
And so it would be rezoned into public facilities rather than into a conditional use residential?
It is up to the landowner to do it either way. They can do it either way.
Oh, okay, because that's not shown here.
Right. Yep, that's just, this is a quite a condensation of the ordinance.
Okay.
The ordinance is, what did we end up with, 45 pages? 48 pages, and this is one page, so it really brings it down to a...
No, it's great. I mean, it's really nice to see it in this way, but it just struck me as strange that if you were creating sole districts, that would have to be a rezoning then rather than a conditional use.
one of the things that the committee, the team that's been working on this, and Charlie has kind of coined this phrase, the truth in advertising. We want the parcel to have the zoning that it should have, mm-hmm. all right, and without any surprises. If a realtor calls and says, what can you do in this district, they will know. Mm-hmm. And it shouldn't be anywhere else unless there's a conditional use permit. And then a lot of lending institutions don't like to see conditions placed on certain things, so they'll go for the actual zoning district, because a conditional use, you can actually put a list of conditions that they're bound by, hours of operation, number of employees, those kinds of things, and sometimes that doesn't work well for the project that's involved. They want to leave it pretty open-ended.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Monica Cruz.
Thank you. My sense of order is kind of offended by this opt-out provision, but you don't seem particularly concerned about that. Maybe wouldn't it be in all our interest if we had like a uniform code that applies to everybody in the county? Are you doing anything in terms of incentives to get people to sign on to this thing?
Well, the
it's like blowing personality.
Nobody likes to be regulated, so okay. Part of the reason for really redoing some of the residential came from our town of Campbell, because if you take a look at the map on the left, the gray area that Charlie was referring to, those are the areas that are zoned agricultural district A, and those all have to be at 1/2 acre in size, okay. That eats up a lot of land. Under residential district A, you only need 10,000 square feet. Okay? So if, let's say, the town of Campbell wanted to opt out, they're going to have to duplicate what our office is doing right now, meeting notices. They're going to have to hold a public hearing. There's going to be appeals. They have to have their own attorney, besides paying for the county office. They're not going to be able to get out of that. So the only thing they're going to be getting from our office is the shoreland zoning, the wetland, floodplain, big things. So the property owner, and we've already tried to paint this picture to these municipalities that think, well, boy, this would be just fun to do. And it's really not, because in the same conversation, what can you do in this zoning district? There's side yards, there's setbacks, there's number of buildings, their square footage, all this, but then they can only talk about one of the five things. If it's too close to the water, they're not in that discussion. They have to send them to us, so it's not very efficient to do it that way. And for a township like maybe the town of Burns, they've been kind of talking about this too. That just doesn't make any sense, because that would be the magnet for everybody that wants to do something you can't do anywhere else. They will pour in there if they don't think they need a zoning ordinance. So we have to keep promoting this. This isn't what they want to do. But it's again, it's their option. It's not ours to them.
Sure. Tex Baker.
Can I answer that just real quickly?
Sure, briefly.
Okay.
Go.
I think, my opinion is that we should have countywide zoning and that all the towns should opt in. But that's pretty arrogant for me to think that I'm always right. You know, it's the state statute ingeniously drafted this opt-out provision, at least, from a standpoint of those local units of government should have the ability to make that decision. If, let's say, there's a county ordinance that's too draconian or a county board that's not in sync with the town. And so I think the best incentive that we've had over the past 10, 15, 20, 30 years is the relationship that we've built between the county and the towns. And yeah, there are always times where the town will disagree with this or the county will disagree with that. We'll never get past that. It's kind of like being married, but I think the best well, it was brief. The best incentive we can give them is to build a good relationship with them. And, understanding that, yeah, we do things that are sometimes controversial. We tell people no at times. And people get upset when they're told no. My kids get upset when they're told no. But somebody's got to be the one telling people no.
And that's like being married and your wife is your boss, is that basically? Chuck Spiker.
I have a question on if the township opts out of county zoning and they request a rezoning of property within the township, does the county have veto power over that? They still do, so mm-hmm. it doesn't. My other question is, I hate to bring up the word because I know you probably won't like it, but it's annexation. A lot of townships plan, and then the village or a city comes in and annexes. My understanding of it, the village and city has all the cards, and they bring it into the zoning that they want to. It's kind of a shame, because at one time, I believe it was the town of Hamilton and the village of West Salem, they recognized this problem. This was years ago, maybe 15, 20 years ago. They said, let us sit down and see if we can come up with a plan. That we know you can annex this. You know, we know you're going to. Can we help in your planning? I don't know if they do that up there anymore, but it certainly was a good idea at the time. Thank you.
And I think the other point with that is this boundary agreements that the state has in their statutes, again, fairly ingenious to put that in the statutes. That's really a place where the towns need to get to think about those boundary agreements to help them with that annexation process, because then that gives them a chance to have the say in planning, in zoning, and maybe help to soften the blow when annexation does happen. And we've tried in many cases to be involved in boundary agreements, and there's just at times so much parochialism that it's difficult to get both sides of the aisle together and talk about a boundary agreement. And sometimes they even blame us. You know, you're the big bad county.
Dan Pina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. I guess on the bottom of the list on that blue sector that we didn't do a lot of talking about it, but I guess would that, let's take the school district. Years and years ago, there was a plan for the West Salem District, and I was on the board at that time, and we put a concept together. Now you're going to regulate that concept. Are those elected officials going to have to jump through the same hoops everybody else does? Because we never regulated them before. And I was wondering, and I don't know what their future plans are. I don't think they need another school in the future. But if they need another school, where they place it is going to have to come before our committee then. And how I'm not sure how this is going to work in that area.
Well, you've got two components that you're working with yet, because the schools were consulted when we were working with the comprehensive plans. Where do you want to see institutional public facilities, those kinds of things, and the county plan, which is more of a general type tool. I think the town of Onalaska was the last municipality outside of the town of Campbell that had schools in their townships.
Yeah.
Okay. So and I think the ones out on Bryce's Prairie have since closed up. So they moved them into the Holman. They've done the combine there. So I don't think as far as schools go, but other institutions that have a lot of public visiting them are going to need sewer and water facilities. That's why the movement. Okay. So in our comprehensive plan, it also indicated that certain kinds of activities should be directed to the municipalities that could properly serve that many people.
No,
so you're not going to see people on a septic or a school on a septic system anymore.
Okay. But they don't need a conditional use permit to build a school then, so.
No.
Okay.
No.
We talked at considerably length about changing the Ag A districts, and you say now they're all phased out. There are a lot of that land is either upgraded or downgraded, and we talked a little bit about that. To upgrade or downgrade, are you planning on putting any fees in that change to go to rural residential, or is that going to be a kind of an automatic, because it was, I think you said, or somebody said, it was 1984 when Ray Pelichek determined where the Ag A land was going to be in the county, and now you're determining that it's not going to be there anymore, and You talked somewhat to our committee about upgrading and downgrading and whether there's a fee with it. I didn't quite understand it, so what is...
Okay, if I can cover the exclusive agricultural district, that is probably the most regulated district that we have. The industrial is probably the opposite end, where anything can actually happen. Exclusive ag is not going to change. We have transitional ag. That's a term that this county board has heard in the past. Under the old farmland preservation, transitional ag was the poorer soil types, the steeper slopes. That was the area, if there was going to be development, that's the area that should have been looked at, because exclusive ag are your prime soils that you shouldn't be building on. We're going to be switching that classification to general agriculture. Okay, and the agricultural district A, which was our residential district out in the out county, that allowed too much. It not only allowed single family, it allowed duplexes, multifamily. So in some areas where there shouldn't be multifamily. And if it's going to happen now, we're going to require a conditional use permit for it. They're going to know that this probably is not a very good area, so they're going to have to really have some real good reason for that. To get back to the down zoning on that, there probably will not be a fee. If you're going to upgrade your property to a higher class than you've got right now, there will be a fee. But we're still trying to determine, and that's going to be up to the committee to do that.
Don Meyer.
Well, Don, Mina touched on a couple questions I had. Will you, as a department, do a blanket deal of particular districts and say these 500 or 300 are going to be rezoned at no cost?
That is in the works. That is one of our goals.
Okay.
Because we want the people to have the correct zoning. Okay. Those are the ones that there probably would not be a charge for.
Okay.
In the meetings that we're starting, and I think that those dates up there, that's going to be the start of talking to the municipalities. Which properties do you guys want flipped at no charge?
Okay.
Because this might be a one-time deal.
Yeah.
You're going to get a one-time free flop. Okay. But if you want to upgrade on something, you're going to pay for it. There's going to be some discussion, so there's going to be a fee.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Ralph Geary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, you're on that assessment reform committee. When you talk about people opting out, the only thing I can think about when I think about most of those people are procrastination.
Exactly.
I don't think anything's going to happen until a specific instance occurs. If it's 3 years from now and they think they can rezone something they can't, they're going to say to you, how do I get a variance? Mm-hmm. And what are you going to say? Is that conditional use or what is it?
Well, like Mr. Handy has indicated, that the municipalities that have formed planning committees, these planning committees have had an opportunity to work with the current zoning code, the same people, the same committee, for about a year now. And that was for a reason, to get them kind of broken in so they really understand what, when people are coming to them, they can end up recommending to the town board with some certainty that this should happen in their municipality. They've reviewed their town plan. So when all this is happening, it's inviting input, where in the past it was, I really hate to say, it was kind of the good old boy, what have you done for me lately kind of a thing. That was supposed to be eliminated when we went to the comp plans. That pre-decides what should happen, unless somebody really gets into their homework and says, I think the plan maybe messed up on me. We should amend our plan to allow me to do this, and then they'll apply for the zoning.
Okay. Are there any Amish farms in La Crosse County?
There's about three of them, maybe four.
Are they treated differently under statute?
Pardon?
They're not treated differently under the five limit.
No, we treat everybody the same way.
Oh, the five limit,
mm-hmm.
And then they'd have to,
mm-hmm.
I guess... With only five kids, I'm not sure they'd be Amish.
I want to talk a little bit about your first question, Ralph. We're not going to hit everybody. We know that. we still haven't hit everybody from the time when we changed the Farmland Preservation Plan in 1980. I think I was 12 at that time. But, you know, 30 years from now, we probably won't have everybody figured out yet. So what we've talked about is maybe having a blanket rezoning process intermittently between now and 30 years from now so that we can get some of those fixed without a fee. You know, maybe there's 17 that come in the town of Holland over a 2 or 3 year period. We say, well, just wait at the end of this time frame, we'll do a blanket rezoning. If you want to rezone right now and improve your situation and it's appropriate with the plan, you can pay the fee, or you can wait, you know, until we get to that blanket. So we've talked about that process. That's not finalized yet.
That's everybody I have on the list, except for now Jill Billings.
Sorry, I was waiting. There's a phrase I don't understand on the summary. Under industrial for conditional uses or something, it says dirty 15. What is that?
The dirty 15 is our projects or activities that probably nobody would want in their neighborhood. So we hold a public hearing on those. And they're usually things that generate smell, fumes.
Like rendering.
Dust, things like that.
Distillation
of bones, those kinds of things that aren't... That really should have a public hearing on them. So even though you have your industrial zoning on it, which I'd mentioned you can do just about anything except the Dirty 15, there's going to be a public hearing on those. The people in the neighborhood are going to know that this is coming in, and they're going to have some say in it.
So are there actually 15 businesses that are designated as...
Correct.
Exactly.
They're
15.
In the... Yeah,
okay.
If you take a look on the county's website, and that's one of the comments that I've got on that handout there. The county website is got this proposed ordinance on your website. It's ordinances, proposed drafts. It's right on your front page. And then if you go under departments and pick zoning, the draft is under there as well, along with these other maps and stuff. So you're welcome.
Maureen Friedland.
Thank you. I wanted to ask about storage units. As I drive around the county, it seems to me as if there are a lot of storage units that, to me, seem to be in residential areas. They may not be residential areas, but will this change this in any way? Will this take them out and leave them in the light and dust? No, in the commercial only, or... can we put them in the dirty 15?
I'm going to let Charlie answer this one. But there's one final thing that I want to wrap up before we're done. Then.
They are allowed or authorized uses in the commercial and light industrial district. They're conditional uses in a number of the residential districts. So they need a conditional use permit to be allowed. Now, there are storage units allowed in the manufactured home community for residents, and then there's a conditional use permit in that district for warehouses that are for outside non-residents. So that's almost exactly the way the code is drafted today. There's not a significant change in the zoning code on that issue.
So when storage units go into residential neighborhoods, since it's conditional use, then there have been notification to neighbors generally and so forth?
Always. Uh-huh. And we go out 300 feet.
Okay,
it's kind of like that well in the town of Utica. If something ends up popping up, the people that receive this within 300 feet, along with the Class 2 notice, it's going to spread out farther than that as well. So anybody can end up coming. It's just not the ones that are notified by mail with the map.
Do you, in your considerations, have you considered more than 300 feet, or is there still room for discussion about that?
There is room for discussion on that. The state statutes indicate, and that's why we use 300 feet, that if there's a protest petition that's been filed, and this only affects zoning cases and not conditional use, and our corporation council just substantiated that not too long ago, that if a protest petition is filed and it's got 75% of those people within that 300-foot ring, that forces the county board to a three-quarter vote rather than a 50 or a half, a majority vote. So, but not a conditional use permit. They don't fall under that protest petition.
Any other questions? Okay, Jeff, you said you had a final comment.
I had one thing, and you guys would probably regret me bringing this up. It's signs. Signs is in the zoning ordinance because the comp plan indicated that we should take a look at that. Under the old ordinance, and I can't remember who I've told this to, under the old ordinance, we regulated signs, but we treated them as accessory buildings. The tallest a sign can be right now is 35 feet. Okay? Under the proposal that we have before us right now, which is the moratorium on the signs along state, federal, and interstate highways, we do not regulate them currently in our zoning ordinance. That moratorium is indicating we should take a look at that. Now, I have no idea how that is going to end up fitting into the adoption of our zoning ordinance. But if we can all work on this with open minds that indicate we don't have to confuse the two, we could end up passing the zoning ordinance without that change, and whenever it's pounded out, so to speak, negotiated, we can amend the ordinance one more time to include that in it. I mean, it's really up to this body how they want to end up handling this, but that's the last thing I'm going to say about the signs.
Okay, and that's all the names, except now Ralph has his hand up.
Because you had to bring up those signs. You said whenever. I thought we had a definite date, 6 months or sooner. That's not whenever. It's 6 months or sooner. I thought we weren't going to procrastinate.
And we're not. The supervisors that are involved in this saw the emails that I've sent out indicating by next month, and I think I had a deadline of June 15th or something like this, I want both sides to submit something. This thing isn't going to be dragged out. But nature has a way of working behind the scenes, too.
All right. Thank you, guys, for the report. Appreciate that.
You're
very
welcome.
Informative. And one more item for Mr. O'Malley.
This is going to be very brief. If we have more, I will put it on your agenda next Thursday. I'm just going to summarize. Out of the state budget that Joint Finance Committee has passed by a 12-4 vote on Saturday, I would summarize to say there are three positive items that were impacted by positions that we've taken. Income maintenance, the committee on a 16-0 vote adopted the WICSA proposal, which Jason and others lobbied very hard on, allowing counties in income maintenance to provide 10 multi-county consortia and a number of details, but I think the night is long so far, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail with that. You also may have read that the Joint Finance Committee changed the requirements on senior care and did not adopt what the governor had proposed. And finally, governor's proposal to eliminate funding on recycling, that was voted down, and the clean sweep funding is unchanged. Those are the three positive items that I see coming out of Joint Finance. There are many negative items that are included in the Joint Finance. So, for example, they changed how much shared revenue would be cut, but it won't benefit us. I haven't seen the final run, but I've seen discussions that it benefits primarily richer suburbs and counties surrounding Milwaukee, but does not benefit us from the most I can tell. At this point, we'll see what the details are when it's done. They still cut youth aids as much as originally proposed. Child support is still underfunded and will lose federal aid. It's still debating right now whether or not the budget repair bill requirements are going to go through. The Supreme Court was hearing those types of things today, so it's unclear whether or not that's going to be added at the last minute, but was not added into Joint Finance. They modified levy limits, and depending on who you talk to, it sounds like it's somewhat less onerous than what the governor proposed. But for us, I don't see any benefit. We're still going to have to go with zero operating levy in each of the next 2 years. They've suspended the
rate limit for 2 years, but given any kind of decline in our total equalized value, would be right up against the rate limit. So it's my position now that I will not be recommending to you anything but a zero next year in operating levy. And the new one that is just shocking as heck to me, and I'm still trying to get caught up, Representative Doyle has been weighing in on this issue, is new highway restrictions, not proposed by the governor, but by the Brain Trust in the legislature to modify how we provide highway services that while they moderated a little bit of the cut in the highway aid, they put all kinds of onerous restrictions on our ability to do work. We would not be able to do any work ourselves that was over $100,000 worth of work that involves federal work or state work. We're not to be allowed as counties to do cooperative work with other counties or municipalities. Certain bidding requirements on that, it goes on and on. I could brag on this for quite a while, but you've been here a while. So we'll be monitoring this over the next week or so. As we see what the legislature will actually do with it, but it is it fundamentally undermines the funding of county highway departments. They seem to forget that in this state, unique among all 50, they don't have their own Department of Transportation. They rely on us to do their plowing and maintenance work during the winter, which is why we have the crews that we have, so that during the off season we need to have them doing other work to actually do that. But there doesn't seem to be anybody at home other than carrying water for private contractors outside this area that want to somehow, without any real thought or planning process, and are threatening counties that, well, if you don't do this, we're going to do it even worse. So it's a real mess, particularly on highways. And our highway representatives are at their conference right now talking about this, but it's a train wreck that will really undermine our ability to continue to do highways as we understand it right now. So there's not a lot of good news coming out of Madison right now. Again, the only good news is Jason and Lori and other leaders in this state have significantly been able to impact what income maintenance changes were there. It's still going to be very difficult, but and Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to abbreviate this as much as I can. I do not have a PowerPoint, you'll be pleased to know. I'm glad I didn't prepare one as long as the rest of this went, but no good news out of Madison.
Anybody have any? Chuck.
Have you heard when they're going to wrap the budget up? It sounds like they're on a very fast track. The Assembly.
Finance has completed its work. It's going to the Assembly probably next week.
I've heard rumors 2 weeks to be done.
The expectation is, what I've heard last, is that the Assembly will debate it and looking at probably doing a fairly minimal number of amendments. Then when it gets over to the Senate, they will declare an impasse basically immediately and go to conference committee, at which point we're expecting collective bargaining and probably redistricting
so
to get added.
So it does go to the Assembly first and then the Senate. The way
this would normally be a year that it starts in the Senate. Tradition has it flip back and forth. But they're sending it to the Assembly first.
And if there's changes made in one body, they have to form a committee then?
Conference committee, which then sends back its recommendation, which is not amendable. And it's at that point that they're...
Up or down.
It's at that point that the expectation is that collective bargaining and redistricting will get put in there. So, but, yeah, you're right. Fast track is what the word is that we're getting at this point. So. Other questions anybody has on that issue? Suggestions for future agenda topics. Anybody have any or announcements? A break? Yeah, we'll take a break. Okay. Jill Billings.
I apologize if this was announced earlier, but there are some women from the county that will be doing a Habitat house build on Saturday. And if anyone is feeling generous toward Habitat or those of us who are trying to raise money, please see me or Marilyn Pedretti. If we could share the funds among ourselves, donate among as as a group. let me change that. We will not share the funds among ourselves. We will make the donations as a group. Thank you.
Any other announcements? Seeing none, motion to adjourn by Karen Johnson, seconded by Jerry Sobranek. All in favor say aye. Opposed, no, carried unanimously. We're adjourned.